Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast with filmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me on this journey through cinema, my two co-pilots. There's Nick Newman, associate editor for the film, associate editor for the Film Stage.
All right.
There we go. And Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
We used to record this podcast in the sky. Now we just record it in the dirt.
Well, I'm glad your opinion of the show has gotten so low, Dick. So today it's a weird week. We couldn't find time to do the Nightcrawler podcast last week, so we're actually going to be releasing Nightcrawler concurrently with our review of Interstellar. So feel free to listen to that as well. This will be the podcast that has all the usual rigmarole on it, as well as, you know, the usual rigmarole, meaning what we've watched at the end, as well as things like Blu-ray releases and theatrical releases that we're looking forward to. In addition to that, we're going to talk about some other random stuff today at the beginning of the show, because we got some feedback from from our Birdman podcast, and we just wanted to be sure that we were able to talk about that, especially because someone had some things to say about Nick, and I think we all need to know what that is. But yeah, other than that, just wanted to tell everyone that you should check out our Twitter page, twitter.com/filmstageshow, and you can also email us whenever you need to at podcast@thefilmstage.com. This episode will be on Interstellar. Before we get into that, though, we had some feedback, and I wanted to read it to you. So, Jerry on Twitter, at Mattervan, I don't even know, had some things to say, and I wanted to put this out to our audience so you can let us know what you think. Jerry said, ahem, clearly you guys are really young college guys who think using big words you don't know somehow validates irrelevant opinions. I will say that I'm 27. I am not in college, and I know the meaning of every big word that I use, and I'm sure that Nick and Danny can say the same. I hope. Danny, can you say the same?
Yes.
Excellent. Then he talks about some other weird stuff. Your show is too far the weird, no one cares to the teen crap. There's no middle for the real quality. Hunger Games next. Jerry, I don't know if we're going to do the Hunger Games. Honestly, it depends on what's coming out that week and if we can make Nick watch it.
Yeah, I'm not going to do it.
Never
going to
watch the Hunger Games? I will probably get dragged into it because I have a friend who really likes it, and I don't have a problem with Jennifer Lawrence. But this is something that I constantly joke about how we have a tendency to go for obscure stuff, though I don't think Birdman is obscure. Maybe it is. I don't know. My theater was packed.
No, that's not obscure.
Right. Like, the color wheel. I'll give you that was obscure, and I'm on your side there, Jerry. But I don't feel like we really get to do the teen stuff much, because, I don't know, I've had to sit through a movie we've watched, and it doesn't feel like we have. The final one, perhaps the best one. You really need to boot the pretentious Nick off the show. He tries so hard to sound important by watching obscure or old junk.
Junk.
Junk, Nick. Are you aware?
That's what you watch, Nick.
You watch fucking junk, Nick.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what to make of this. On the one hand, we do have a tendency to really move between extremes, because sometimes something comes out and it doesn't seem like we really need to talk about it. So we go for something that maybe other people haven't have heard or seen. And, you know, it's kind of our way of saying, hey, there's a lot of cinema out there. Maybe you should check it out. Maybe that's not what we should be doing. Also, from our Birdman podcast, we got some comments. Anthony Polario said, no Dark Knight as Nolan's best movie? Plus one for your Nolan bingo boards. I love The Dark Knight, man. I just think The Prestige is better. I mean, Would we all agree that Dark Knight is towards the top, though?
Sure.
Sure.
Thanks, guys. Also, talking about directors that maybe we've fallen out of love with, Guest, thank you, Guest, said Tarantino can get a bit tiring, but you know what to expect going in. It's weird, I actually had a conversation about this last night. I had talked to a couple people who said that with Django Unchained, they were getting kind of tired of Quentin Tarantino's kind of melange of different genres aesthetic. Is this something that you all have noticed? Maybe not in your own capacity, but not... Like being able to take all the homages and everything and craft a new thing. Like, they were saying that they kind of miss the old Tarantino. You know, they want more Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction.
I don't know. It all feels like him to me, I guess.
That's the argument that I made, but...
I also think he's grown as a formalist, definitely, at least since Reservoir Dogs, which on just a pure craft level is not the most amazing piece of work. I think that he's grown exponentially. And I'm curious with The Hateful Eight, because that seems like it's going to be a much smaller kind of film. It seems like they'll be satisfied there, because I described it to people as sort of a Western Reservoir Dogs, in a way. And I'm curious how the 70mm will impact that a bit. But, yeah.
Danny King, have you noticed any like drop-off in your enjoyment of the Tarantino?
I think I still enjoy them, but I feel like there are people that are less in love with his recent work than the earlier stuff. So
part of it, Nick, like you said, is that he has grown as a formalist. And so sort of that like grungy early 90s independent aesthetic is gone. And that maybe that leaves people feeling cold, because what they loved about him was how dangerous he felt.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I still think his current films have a lot of kind of like shaky approaches in them, a lot of things that are very uncomfortable.
Right.
Whatever.
Final comments here to address. Rally in the Streets. Sure. Laughed at the guy who got annoyed at the film's takedown of critics, referring to Birdman. So many critics are arrogant and pretentious, Nick. They deserve to be taken down a notch or three. And then he says, well, I guess, I don't know what we'd be pretentious about. Arrogant, I can get, because I get arrogant. I don't know. It's just that, like I said, it was done best in Ratatouille. Also, games aren't art, never have been, never will be. Even when they're dressed up with artful visuals and music, which are the art, the game aspects are not art. I actually tend to agree with that. Especially with relation to how the game aspects kind of destroy any art in there. But that's a really long conversation for another day. Or never.
The only thing I would say is I don't think we were annoyed at the film's takedown because it was like that character represented what a good critic should be like, and we were upset that it was criticizing that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I think it's not like we were like, oh man, she's a great critic, why do they have to take her down?
Yeah, no, I mean, she was just a shit critic. And it's like, she deserved to be taken down, but it would have been great if there was, like, an earnest critic who wasn't just a sin. And it doesn't, it, you know.
Who cares?
You're not helping your case here, Nick. And then, yeah.
I'm not trying to make a case. I don't have to prove myself to anybody. So.
It's pretty arrogant.
Sure. But I don't know, when someone sends a message complaining about us being too snobbish and can't get basic rules of grammar down, I guess I don't really care, so.
Shots fired. All right, well, right into the podcast at the Film Stage Show, or comment on the articles posted on the Film Stage, or tweet at us at Film Stage Show. That's it for that. Let's actually get into our main review of Christopher Nolan's newest film, co-written with him and his brother, Jonathan, and that is Interstellar, starring Matthew McConaughey, Anne Hathaway, Jessica Chastain, John Lithgow, and Michael Caine.
Keep going.
I could keep going, but I won't. Here's the trailer.
This world's a treasure. It's been telling us to leave for a while now.
Your daughter's generation will be the last to survive on Earth. You're the best pilot we ever had.
get out there and save the world.
Everybody ready to say goodbye to our solar system? To our galaxy. Here we go.
So Interstellar takes place in a distant or possibly not too distant future wherein ecological collapse has basically left the world 100%, well, not 100%, 98% uninhabitable. Dust bowls are occurring. Crops are failing. Pretty much the only thing we have left is corn. And mankind has basically let the fires of humanity die. And they've huddled around the last embers, and they're waiting to either, you know, starve to death or just kind of slowly blink out of existence. Enter into this Cooper, who is Matthew McConaughey's character, a former pilot for NASA, which has since been disbanded. And because of some happenings in his daughter's room, he actually is able to discover a secret plan to save humanity by launching us to the nearest, or the furthest reaches of space in order to find a new homeworld. Thus begins a space and time spanning odyssey to hopefully not save the planet, not save the world, but save humanity. Big movie. Big ideas. Literally big movie, because Christopher Nolan has been pretty emphatic that you should see this on the biggest screen possible. We did it! Let's see what we thought. Nick Newman, what did you think of Interstellar?
Well, it's funny you say the whole thing about having to see it on a big screen, you know, with the extravagant presentation, because that's what I did. And I found that the experience of doing so was important to my enjoyment of the film, because this is how Nolan would prefer you see it. He has shot somewhere north of an hour of his film in 70mm IMAX, which is very, not just a very big presentation, but also a very clear presentation. Very sort of look close enough and you feel like you can fall into it kind of thing. And that enhanced the experience for me. It's funny because on a basic level, I'm not sure how much I would like this film if it wasn't for that sort of spectacle quality, but it's difficult to judge it totally just because I know that this is how it's meant to be seen. And so there is sort of this push-pull for me between little things the movie does wrong that kind of amount to bigger problems and seeing it in a very particular manner. That much being said, I'm just going to speak from my own experience and say that I quite enjoyed the film. I was surprised at some of the things Nolan was able to get over in this movie, I suppose you could say. The way that some of his own obstacles, a very deliberate coldness that I think he doesn't do that much to fight. I think he's definitely good at creating stirring spectacle, but as far as human emotion is concerned, he tends to make movies that are about cold people. Yeah. And it is interesting how now he's making a movie about a family man, a father, and I think he packs some worthwhile statements on that sort of responsibility into his film. I think that he's able to make it a sort of a convincing compromise that this character makes, where he's abandoning his family. I mean, he's pulling a Richard Dreyfuss here, specifically in Close Encounters. I don't know if Richard Dreyfuss abandoned his family in real life, but
I was about to say, it took me a real good time to think about what movie you were actually talking to.
Right.
I was like, Mr. Holland's Opus, I guess, like emotionally.
That was something I found interesting, kind of how this movie is not really that afraid to look at both sides of it. I mean, it's easy to if you want to create, it's understandable that you would if you want to create a certain dramatic tension, but I think it gives a good footing to both Matthew McConaughey and eventually Jessica Chastain as his older daughter, Murph Cooper. Boy, if that doesn't sound like a made-up name. And
well, I was thinking, I mean, her name is Murphy, right?
Murphy Cooper still sounds a little, I don't know. But anyway, like scientist Murphy Cooper, come on. But otherwise,
the science advisor on this movie was Kip Thorne. I mean, that's a made-up sounding name.
Kip Thorne?
Yeah.
I guess, but it's got a little more pep.
He does have more pep, I'll give you that. All right, please continue.
It's funny because, you know, Nolan is often criticized for his rampant use of exposition, but I do think that in this movie, at least, it is justifiable why you would have that, because people need to explain why something is going to happen. And I, the thing is, I don't really ever mind Nolan's exposition that much, because I think it does a good job of establishing stakes, and I think it does a good job of, you know, sort of indicating what is going to come, and yet I think that he is able to justify telling you what is going to happen by actually making the sight of it an interesting sight, by making it something that creates excitement. And it feels like it's part of the overall narrative. And what's funny is that this movie, I think, is probably his best example of setting up stakes and paying them off. I think it's interesting how he has this sort of groan-inducing this groan-inducing conversation about what love really is. And it's like, it's pretty bad, but the thing is, then Anne Hathaway's character has this line where she wants to see her husband or lover or whatever, and says something along the lines of, you know, I'm on the other side of the universe and he could be near me. And it's little lines like that which kind of, I think, reconfigure some of the more problematic Nolanisms.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Nolanisms can be sort of, I think they're sort of reconfigured a bit because he's working in a new genre. And it's certain things like this. And I also find the use of 70mm really fascinating. I think that there actually is sort of a thematic intent in the way that it is specifically employed in certain scenes. I find it so interesting how the first time you see it in this movie is actually a dream or a flashback that the character is having, and how that kind of takes over. You know, he's kind of returning to, not returning to a previous life, but he's kind of getting back into something that he sort of missed. And he's doing this sort of at the expense of his own family. When 70mm becomes his dominant form, it's almost as if spectacle is taking over his life and his own actions. I thought that was fascinating. For me, there was kind of this thing where it just, there's a lot of, a lot of times dialogue is surrendering to images in this film. The way that kind of certain things will be said inside a spaceship cabin, and that's kind of important, but then you go outside and it's so beautiful and you kind of forget about it, and it feels like the movie is willing to let you forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in IMAX 70mm, I mean, that was, I saw this at the Lowe's Lincoln Square, which is one of the biggest IMAX screens in the world, I believe, and that was... yeah, it was an enveloping experience. So I don't know if I'll see the movie again, at least not in the format, in that same format, but I don't really need to. I saw it, and I enjoyed it, and I know why I enjoyed it, and I think there are... I definitely think it is a film of merit. So, I'm positive on Interstellar.
I am in shock. Anyway, I'll let that... I'll let that hang pretentiously. Danny King, what did you think about Interstellar?
Whoa. I'm stunned.
I purposefully have not published, even on Twitter or Facebook, a single reaction to this film because I was waiting for this moment. So anyway, Danny King, what did you think of Interstellar?
I'm just so stunned right now.
And did you see this on a large format?
Yeah, I saw it in the same theater Nick did on a different day.
Oh, okay.
Yesterday. And... I also like the film. I do think it's like...
I was going to say, in fifth-dimensional space, you technically saw it at the same time.
Yeah, Nick, it was fun seeing it together, right?
Mm-hmm. So like when I reached my hand out?
Yeah, that was kind of creepy. It was like you're... Yeah. So I really like the movie. It is one of those things that's sort of like... It's frustrating to watch a little bit because there's just so many things that are bad. By the end of it, I'm pretty willing to just not really prioritize those flaws. But I mean, in terms of his reliance on exposition, it doesn't really bother me so much to hear a lot of dialogue and a lot of jargon all at once. The problem with it is I think it almost seems to bore the actors in a sense where I don't feel like they can even get into their characters in a way that they would like, as much as they're just sort of really fighting to find a way to deliver a line as if they were actually a NASA scientist. I mean, there are a few lines in this that Anne Hathaway sells or that some of the other astronauts sell, but a lot of it just seems like them trying to get through jargon-heavy lines as casually as possible. And oftentimes, some of the explanations and the way they sort of balance explaining it to the fellow astronauts versus explaining it to the audience is just really kind of awkward. There's one line that I think the astronaut Romilly, who's played by David Giassi, probably pronouncing that wrong, it's just a long speech, and at the end of it, he's like, "That's relativity, folks." And it's just sort of like, yeah, like, I'm sure they sort of know what you're talking about. Like, you don't have to really say that. And there's a lot of discussions of relativity where they're explaining it in ways that's clearly audience intended. So it just feels like a dead scene because the characters aren't actually gaining anything from it. And I think that's sort of a necessity of the scale that Nolan is working on, so it's sort of, you can kind of go with it, but that's sort of what bothers me most about his exposition. But in terms of stuff I liked about the movie, there is the sort of Spielberg quality to it that's appealing, and Matthew McConaughey is a lot more kind of charming and lighter than typical Nolan protagonists. I mean, for me, almost one of the most, like, wonderful scenes in the movie is the early scene where he and his kids are, like, in their truck driving after this plane through cornfields, and the truck is, like, plowing through corn, and it's, like, before the movie, you know, ever gets going into its space narrative and stuff like that. But it just seems like his face and his kids' face and the way they look at the airplane, it's very charming and just, like, very nice, and I thought that had a spirit that was set up nicely. And there's also a different DP than Nolan's usual films, Hoyt Van Hoytema, and I think what he does...
Isn't that Jerry Lewis's cinematographer?
Correct. Is there a reasoning behind that joke?
Just because if you say the name, it's like, Hoytema,
right.
That is the most obscure goddamn joke.
So the joke is that if he said it, it would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, I guess, just sounds like a Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But, I mean, I think the stuff he does with Dust is, like, really great. I think the movie starts off looking pretty great, except there's weird documentary-style moments with Ellen Burstyn. I mean, if there's one thing I didn't expect to see in the opening minutes of Interstellar, it was a documentary interview with Ellen Burstyn, so that sort of, like, shocked me. I was, like, really hoping that would go away after about 5 minutes, and it did, so that was fortunate. But also, once it gets into space, there are a lot of images on faces, and the way the light is playing on their helmets is very nice. And there's another kind of standard shot in the movie where he's got the camera, like, harnessed to a vehicle. So there's a good one when, like, McConaughey is driving away and the camera's sort of, like, on the side of the truck as he leaves. And all of the shots where the camera's sort of harnessed to the spacecraft and it's kind of spinning, those were really beautiful. And to see it in IMAX, of course, was great. One thing that's interesting about the IMAX experience is, like, I mean, the image is so huge and it's so clear. Afterwards, my friend said to me, like, you know, I think the costume designer on that was really amazing. When they like, these astronauts are walking around, I was almost, like, looking at the fabric on their uniforms. And I'm like, yeah, that's great costume design, but it's also, like, just the amazing clarity of the image. It's like you can actually see things like that and they're right in your face.
Yeah, and it's not like the 48 FPS thing.
Oh,
it
seemed
like a costume. Like, it just gives texture.
Yeah, it's so much texture. And I almost, at a certain point, like, want him to just make a movie that's all in IMAX, because it is sort of a weird experience. Every time the image shifts and becomes taller, there's sort of this thing like, oh shit, something big's about to happen. And it kind of, I mean, it's fun and it sort of, like, provides this anticipation, but I do find that, like, constant shifting in aspect ratios to be a little bit, like, not ideal. I feel like at a certain point he's just got to make the whole thing in IMAX. Maybe that would require him to make, like, a movie of normal length. that's just a sacrifice he'll have to make. But So that's one other thing about seeing it in that format. And if I did see it again, I would actually almost prefer to see it not in IMAX, just to compare how it plays all widescreen. But yeah, so I think those are some initial thoughts, but I did like the film. I mean, for all of its problems, it does have some of his most moving scenes that we can describe later on. Mm-hmm. And so by the end, I was just sort of like, it was such a warm idea of a movie that I'm just like, yeah, good job, Nolan.
So in the run-up to this movie, I did something that I don't usually do, and I looked at some of the criticism that had been published about it, and some of it was, I guess, I won't say very negative, but not, like, possibly more negative than it should have been. It just seems like people have it out for Nolan a lot. And I'd been reading some of the criticisms about it, and a lot of it was like, oh, it's like just everyone's an exposition machine, the sentimentality doesn't work, just a lot of stuff like that.
Now's a good time to say that the comments on the Film Stages review,
oh, they're stunning,
are incredible.
Really?
Have you read them?
I have not read the comments on the Film Stages review.
The review was written by the inimitable Peter Labuza, who is very much not a Nolan fan. And I actually was supposed to review it, but he messaged me, I think, like a day before the screening, and he said, hey, are you, you know, can I take over? Because I want to, the publicist is kind of bothering me about it. And so I said, yeah, okay, sure. Knowing that this was kind of knowing what was going to happen. also because I just figured he tends to get more traffic when he writes stuff. But anyway.
Anyway, so what I was saying.
Okay, so go on. So, it just that, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you've shown me this. Jesus. So, and so I was getting nervous because I know Nolan. I've been with him since the beginning. I know that he likes to set up his games, and he can just put himself into explanation. I mean, that's pretty much all Inception is. Even the emotional parts of Inception, the emotions are only being explained insofar as they relate to the mechanics of this heist that they're trying to pull off. So I went into this film aware of what people had been saying wrong about it, which usually makes it a lot easier to see it. You know, if you're looking at a picture and you think it's beautiful, and then someone says, yeah, but if you see right there, there's like a huge flaw in the foreground, that's the only thing you'll ever be able to see. And if you have never seen the picture, and then someone says, yeah, keep an eye out for that huge flaw in the foreground, and you go in, that's going to be the first thing you look for. So I was primed, unfortunately, to notice every flaw in this movie walking into it, which was my own fault.
That's why you don't
surprisingly, I didn't see a goddamn one of them.
What?
I didn't see the flaws. I got out of the film. First of all, I'm sitting there and I'm waiting for these over-explanatory moments to come through. I'm waiting for these 5-minute long scenes of explaining relativity to happen, and they don't. This movie is not perfect, I'll give you that. I mean, it can't be. It's so big, and it's wrestling with so many ideas and so many emotions and just so much volume and mass of both intellectual and emotional extremes. How could it be perfect? But it doesn't need to be perfect. I fucking loved this movie. And the reason I said I was shocked after Nick's statement is because I was almost certain that I would have to come on here and defend this movie against both of you.
I haven't disliked any Nolan films. I mean,
but there was just, I don't know what it was. I guess it's just, I don't know.
I think I like this more, definitely more than like Dark Knight Rises for sure.
There's just like, I guess there's just a part of me that after reading all the negative criticism, and I read more once I'd seen the movie, this is the only movie that I've ever liked and then felt weird about liking, because I'm like, there are a lot of people that I respect who did not like this movie, but I don't understand it. I don't see it. And even reading their reviews again, or reading like the more spoilery takedowns they've done, I just don't see it. I don't get it. This, I mean, Nolan is not an emotional filmmaker, and his ability to transition into scenes of extreme emotional weight, it kind of acts as a counterpoint to anyone who's ever said, like, he doesn't have the ability. It's like, no, it's just never been important to him. And this movie, it is, and so it happens. And, I mean, it's just the sheer scale of the movie overwhelms you, and the sheer audacity of the story overwhelms you, and the scale of the journey overwhelms you. And then you get down to the more intimate portraits. There are scenes in this movie where a person is simply watching a video screen or sitting on their bed talking to their daughter that had me almost in tears. And there's just, I just feel like on a basic level, like, I'm so thrilled at a movie that posits NASA as the S.H.I.E.L.D.-esque heroes of humanity. Of a movie that can look up into the stars and not see terrifying aliens or the godlike power of the sun or something like that, but to see the infinite possibilities afforded to us by the enormity of the universe and our ability to create and to think our way out of problems and to feel our way out of problems. I just, it was like a full force, incredible experience to sit there and be witness to this, and to realize that in a world where we're getting 28 different comic book movies a year for the next 40 years of our lives, all of which will have some variant on the world is in peril and some guy in a suit has to save it, that here we're looking at people who are being guided by that impulse to explore, to find out things about the unknown, to continue on out of pure love rather than duty. I mean, it's amazing. The fact of this film's existence is almost enough to make up for the flaws that are there, because you can't make an undertaking this big, that goes this far, that wrestles with these ideas and have it be perfect. There's just no time for that. There's no room for it. It's a humanity and our place and the way that we've expanded and the way that we care about each other is a huge, chaotic, messy, awful history. And you can't make a film about it that sands off those edges, that's able to make it any less nonsensical than it is. If you were to let friends listen to the way that you talk to a person that you're in love with, you would be embarrassed for yourself. Because that's what that does to you. And this is a movie that doesn't shy away from that. I put it up with The Fountain in that way. Like, people are gonna hate the fact that there are certain moments in this film where people argue compellingly for the existence of love as, like, a force in the universe. But it worked for me. It worked for me. This movie just worked for me. And I was so worried that I was going to have to come here and make an impassioned emotional argument with one or both of you, trying to make you understand that. And it actually, like, really enforces how much I enjoy doing this podcast with you two, because I don't have to do that. I love you guys.
Great movie. I love this movie now.
Oh, my God. So I'm sorry that I went on a rant there, but it's just like, I've done my best, because, like, not a lot of my friends have seen this movie, to not say a single thing about it to anyone, because I don't want to pollute their impression of the film like mine was, because I don't know that they'll have the mechanism to, like, just let all that go, like I apparently did, even though I think the movie is good at doing that. But yeah, so that's my thoughts. Formally, it's a very good movie. Beautiful cinematography. yeah, I love the hell out of this movie. What are you humming about?
No, I was just reading an interesting news story.
Oh, fuck off, Nick.
I'm not being dishonest.
I hate you so much.
Okay.
Yeah, I was supposed to say, I just don't know how early we want to do spoilers.
I was about to say, the other thing is, like, that a lot of this film is spoilers. I will say before we get into spoilers that Mackenzie Foy, who plays Murph at age 10, is amazing and is capable of stealing this movie from literally everyone on screen.
Mm-hmm.
That the world it sets up is a, like, the most bleak and terrifying world I've ever seen, and I've seen The Road 3 times. Just because of the way that it kind of posits this future in which, like, science and exploration and everything will be destroyed. And it doesn't seem hard to comprehend, honestly. And the way that people think of science and exploration as just being like, ooh, televisions and cell phones. And I think there's a lot of good, funny and emotional retorts done to that. I think that the script is possibly, you know, well, let's just be honest. This is the warmest film Christopher Nolan has ever made. And I think that the script buoys that, the performances buoy that. And I think that the cinematography and the camera work buoy it as well. I think that there's a lot in this film that works really well together. It coheres pretty beautifully. So that's my non-emotional response. That's my analytical mind kicking in. is there anything to say now that we've said all of that outside of spoilers? What do we think of the music? Because I heard people bitching about the music too, and I honestly loved it.
Yeah, I actually,
the score's great.
Right, the score's fucking great.
Yeah, I like the score, and I also was also based on early word expecting a more difficult sound design.
Yeah, the sound balance and everything in mind was
Yeah, better. Like, Nick, when you saw it, did you have trouble hearing anything?
I did, unfortunately.
You did?
Especially at a critical moment involving a certain actor. It kind of made the whole thing difficult to follow because okay. There was very muddy sound design when a certain reveal happens, so I actually didn't really know why. Yeah. I guess I sort of understood why something was happening, but it actually, like, kind of dulled the whole effect.
Okay. I guess I was, maybe the sound design was muddled, but I guess I was expecting a more kind of constantly loud score when it was actually more restrained, I thought. Like, definitely when it gets to the emotional, like, set pieces, it's pretty prominent. But
yeah, but I was
the moments when I couldn't hear the dialogue was, like, mix-related and not, like, because Zimmer was, like, freaking out and like, going too extreme.
Oh, man. Okay, well, yeah, now that we've talked about all that, we can get into some of the plot-heavy things, really examine some of the ideas on point here. So let's get into it. Spoilers for Interstellar, beginning now. So I think one of the things I'll say first is how refreshing it is to watch a movie where the computers don't go crazy and try to kill everyone.
Mm-hmm.
There are two robots that are actually very interestingly designed, Tars and Case, who have a lot of personality for robots. I'm sure that someone here could make a joke about how they have more personality than anyone who's ever been in a Christopher Nolan film. But honestly, they're really good. And I think that the way that they're kind of explained and their like honesty and humor like levels, it's kind of funny how those are played around with. And, it's also interesting how those ideas come back towards the climactic point of the movie.
What's funny too about the design of the robots is like it takes you really long to understand all of their capabilities.
Yeah.
And there's a really funny line in Ignaty Vishnevetsky's review of the film where he talks about how Nolan has this visual style where it's like every shot is basically constructed just to give you like one piece of information. So it's like for the first 2 hours, you have one idea of like what these robots are. Like they're just sort of these talking things. And then all of a sudden when they need to be like mobile, it's like, holy shit. Like now they have all these other, so it's like kind of funny how in that sense, like his sort of visual single-mindedness kind of plays into like the wonder of these robots. Like what the hell would they do next? Like they're like pinwheeling and like,
yeah, that scene when they, first of all, the planets that they visit in this movie are like, they're simple planets, but they're conceived of and shown in such a way that actually increased the wonder in a way that, like, something like the ice planet Hoth didn't do.
Like, to the wonder.
Yes, I was... Oh, God damn it, Danny. But they land on this water planet, and the water appears to only be, like, 2 feet deep at most.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that scene where you see this robot, like, have to get moving and basically turn itself into a pinwheel, I was like, wow, that's fucking incredible. Like,
it's shocking, basically. It's a pretty awesome.
Yeah, like, it kind of just looked like the creepers from Minecraft. And now it's like moving like a son of a bitch. But yeah, I mean, I love the fact that it's just that optimistic about technology, that like, we've created this thing and it's not going to go HAL on us. You know, it's not going to like lie to us or destroy us or try to save the mission in its own fucked up way. And that in fact, the closest the mission comes to being sabotaged is by the same impulse that makes the mission necessary in the first place, which is like survival and a need for other people. And that is in the weird cameo by Matt Damon.
Very, very interesting cameo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were our thoughts on this moment in the film? Because I could see this as being a problem point for some people.
I enjoy his presence. I don't know. It didn't really bother me, I guess. I'm not sure why people would be bothered by it, except that it is kind of funny when he it's just Matt Damon showing up.
Just the fact that there's Matt Damon.
What actually bothers me is that probably the film's clunkiest dialogue exchange is in the
scene. Is
it like
when they're walking or like...
No, it's because they get to the station Lazarus and Matt Damon says, "You just raised me from the dead." Matt Damon goes, "Lazarus." And it's just, you know, it's like, oh, fucking thanks. Thanks for telling me. So here's the thing. If I had written the film, the dialogue exchange would be, you've raised me from the dead. That would be a much better exchange.
We all know, Coop. We all know.
You don't need to say it out loud, sure. But yeah, that was terrible. Otherwise, I don't know. I mean, it's funny because I do enjoy his presence, but my enjoyment of the actual section was dulled by the fact that the IMAX sound makes me difficult to figure out exactly what was going on. And so when he kind of just like pushes him down a hill or something, I was kind of thinking, wait, what?
Stunning.
And then when he says something, it just kind of sounds like, I just kind of had to.
Well, I'm sad
there.
That you missed it, because that exchange dialogue was pretty loaded.
Well, what does he say? It's stupid that I have to ask this. But...
So Matt Damon's character is talking about how, like, the reason they sent people on this mission instead of robots is that people are more adaptable and they have completely illogical ways of staying alive and reasons to stay alive. They have a self-preservation mechanism that you can't really program into a robot. And then, as they're walking, it becomes clear that there is no surface to this planet, that it's all just these frozen clouds that are kind of circling around, I guess, a gaseous core. And the reason that Matt Damon, the leader of this mission, the man who spearheaded this expedition off into the stars, the reason that he said it was viable is because he had basically given up hope that this planet would be viable, and he knew that the only way that he would ever get another person back to this area is to push the button on his thing that said, yes, this is a viable planet, come here. And so now he's going to, like, he's trying to hijack their ship in order to make it back to Earth. There's that great moment when they've just rescued him and he says something like, pray you never know how good it can be just to see another face.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it gets pretty bleak. I was honestly, this is something that Christopher Nolan's really good at. I never feel safe in one of his movies. it is never my assumption that a character will survive or make it out. So, like, I constantly believed that it was possible that Batman could fail. I never feel like Iron Man's going to fail. I never feel like Captain America's not going to make it. I never felt like Superman wasn't going to make it. So it's not just a Marvel thing. It's just Christopher Nolan has this ability to wring tension to a point that I honestly believe that he would be... And again, it's part of his coldness. I think he'd do it. I honestly thought that Cooper was going to die.
Yeah, I did too.
And then there's the great moment when Matt Damon has gotten back to the spaceship and he's like about to make one of those classic, you know, I'm a bad guy, but I'm going to justify myself speeches. And he doesn't even get through like the opening sentence before he is brutally killed in an explosion because he does not know how to dock a spaceship on this thing.
I remember that part.
It was great. It scared the shit out of me.
Yeah, I didn't have any problems with like his specific section. It's just that the second half of the movie got a little bit twist heavy, particularly Michael Caine's death scene seemed really awkward. And it was like that compounded with this twist was just like stuck out to me as just awkward narrative like management. Honestly, yeah. That Michael Caine death scene was like, for me, like, kind of bad. I don't know.
I didn't mind it. It was pretty... It's pretty brutal, however, that he doesn't tell her that her father had no idea he wasn't going to be able to come back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Michael Caine's kind of a dick in this movie. It's just... It's interesting to see, like... Because there's an interesting interplay there. So, Cooper... Matthew McConaughey's character left his daughter Murph behind with the intention of coming back. And then similarly, Anne Hathaway, who plays Brand, is the daughter of Michael Caine, and she left her father behind with the intention of coming back. And of that, like, quartet, only one of them knew that that was never going to happen again. And it was, there was one dad who was willing to let his little girl go and another dad who left his little girl. And one of them was perfectly fine with the fact that it was over.
Mm-hmm.
And he is not the guy who saved the world. Obviously something could be read into that. So, I want to talk about the emotional core of this movie briefly. There's a lot of talk about love being this. And I will admit that I was nervous about this movie because there were a couple of interviews where Christopher Nolan brought up the concept of like, you know, how do you account for love? Like, you know,
yeah.
there was a really...
There's a Vulture story that has one of the worst quotes possible you could give
what is
to
it?
Build up a movie. Let me find this. I have to read it. I cannot not read it verbatim.
Yeah, I was about to say, we wouldn't do it justice unless we read it verbatim.
There's this Vulture story that was published on October 16th, 2014, by Nate Jones, and it's called 15 New Details About Interstellar. And point four is pretty groan-inducing. Okay. Four, the film's central question, according to Nolan, what happens when scientists bump up against these things that defy categorization and analysis, like love?
Right. When you read it like that, it sounds terrible, and it's really difficult to read it any other way.
Let's go bump up against love, guys.
Yeah. You got a love bump. Anyway, God, I'm so upset that I just said that. So, but the way that he does it, I think, is indicative of the way that Nolan can really examine certain ideas. I mean, the speech that Anne Hathaway gives, because there's a point in the movie where they've accidentally spent 23 years on a planet, which is pretty... Like, oh my God, leads to one of the most heart-wrenching scenes in the movie when they've been down on this planet for maybe like 3 hours, but because of relativity and the way gravity acts upon time, they've actually been down there 23 years in like Earth time, and they have 23 years worth of messages waiting for them, and they've only been gone 3 hours. And I just can't even imagine. I can't even imagine the impact that that must have. And then watching those videos and seeing Matthew McConaughey's reaction. I mean, this guy is an unstoppable force. And this movie has so many points where it just depends on his emotional reaction really working that through. But so they've lost a lot of fuel because they were down there for 23 years. And they have to make a choice between which planet to go to still have enough fuel for a return journey home. And there's the planet that was found by the guy who like spearheaded the mission, who was like a brilliant, great guy. And then there was one where there was a receiver and it was saying go, but then it stopped. And Anne Hathaway wants to go to the second planet. Matthew McConaughey knows that this is because she was actually in love with Edmund, the leader who had gone to that planet. And Anne Hathaway makes what is perhaps the only rational argument for following your heart that I've ever heard. She says, you know, there's no social utility in loving the dead. Like, evolutionarily, being in love with people who aren't around you, it doesn't make sense. Like, there is a force to it, like a real moving force. And it spanned across the entire galaxy. It spans across time. Maybe that's good enough. Like, in a situation where you have very little else to go on, maybe that should be enough. And, like, yeah, I mean, it's a very compelling way to illustrate and expound upon the point that Christopher Nolan said in that groan-inducing line in Vulture. Was anyone, like, did anyone not enjoy that? Or did anyone have a problem with that moment in the movie? Because that's another one of those moments where I was like, this could be an issue for people.
The Hathaway moment?
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it was, parts of that speech were a little bit silly. The thing that's weird about it is, like, this is NASA. And, like, at a certain point, Cooper would just be like, we gotta, like, follow what we know. I think.
But that's like, basically what he says. Like, that's his entire argument against her.
Right. But I guess, like, my thing is, like, this actually happened. Like, that conversation wouldn't even be happening. Like, she would probably know to be like, I can't do that. Like, actually suggest this idea.
But she did. And I think that's another... fact that she does, after having been so kind of... not open about things before, is just another, you know, to quote Huey Lewis, that's the power of love.
Power of love.
That is not how that song goes.
I'm with you on the phone calls. And the thing that's weird, though, is, so, like, a lot of this movie, like, the narrative shifts are just driven by Nolan's sort of, like, allegiance to science. And, like, I mean, Kip Thorne is a producer, so it's, I mean, he's probably like fact checking this script with him, and so it leads to moments that are both amazing and moments that are really awkward, but that he still, like, needs to put in there. So, like, right before the phone calls, I think it's before, is when they stumble upon, like, Romilly. Mm-hmm. Who's, like, standing there. And to me, that moment's awkward when he's just sort of like, what up? Been here for, like, 20 years. Like, got a beard. Like, that seems like a scene that he just, like, needs to get in there. Yeah. But then at the same time, like, his allegiance to the fact, like, yields a scene like McConaughey's watching those videos, which is just amazing. And there was a point in that moment where the first shot on McConaughey is held really long. And I almost thought he was going to, like, keep that shot for the whole scene. Yeah, and that would have been kind of, but I think at a certain point you need the reverse shots. And what that also does is, like, each time it cuts back to McConaughey, it's like the emotions are all the more complicated and different. And so I think that actually benefits the scene ultimately.
There's a part of that scene that rips me apart. Because it plays into an earlier scene that ripped me apart. When he's on his bed, or on his daughter's bed, and he's, like, you know, promising her that he'll be back. And then the little girl, little Mackenzie Foy, who is going to, like, just... I'm going to watch what she does next, because she's obviously great. But I'm going to hate her forever, because when she says just when... as he's like holding her and she's crying and he's like, I'll be back. And she says, when? I like was, my heart was like ripped from my chest and thrown against a wall of spikes. And then when Jessica Chastain basically echoes that sentiment and says, you know, you once told me that, you know, but you might be the same age as me when you get back. Like, you know, and it's my birthday and it'd be really good to have you back. And she like breaks down crying. I was like, oh man.
Very well done.
Yeah. And I just wouldn't expect it from a Nolan film.
Yeah. Cause I remember when her phone call started, I was like, okay, like the reasoning here might be a little suspicious. Like when she just says my birthday, I'm like, oh, is that really what deal is? But then she says that.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, okay, that works. Like, that's good.
Can we point out that this whole idea is kind of stolen from Aliens? Is it?
I
mean, it kind of is. Because at least the director's cut of Aliens, when Ripley finds out she's been in space for something like 75 years, and she sees a photo of her daughter, who's now in her 80s, and she has the line, like, I told her I'd be back for her 8th birthday.
Oh, wow. I actually don't remember that.
I don't know.
That's stunning.
I'm not saying it's stolen, but it,
I mean, honestly, it's a, it's kind of a play on an earlier Matthew McConaughey space exploration movie, Contact.
Yeah, I haven't seen Contact.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There's a point in that movie where he literally says to Jodie Foster, you know, because of relativity and everything, you know, you may make it back safe, but by the time you get back, everyone you love and care about could be gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's just relativity theory, yeah. So...
It's the same reason that Anakin Skywalker can be 6 in Phantom Menace, but be, I don't know, 27 and the same age as Padme when he gets back in Attack of the Clones? Okay, let's not talk about Star Wars anymore. what also could be a chilling and problematic, or just a problematic point in this movie is when... I'm just hoping that no one's listening to this, hoping that we're going to explain the movie because it's so long. I hope that if you're in the spoiler section, you've actually seen it. There's a point where they're using the gravitational pull of a black hole as a means of making up for a fuel deficiency. And they jettison 2 capsules to allow for enough inertia to carry this spaceship to the 3rd viable planet, hoping amongst all hope that there's actually going to be able to be a place there. A couple of things about the scene. I mean, Matthew McConaughey jettisons himself into the black hole after having jettisoned TARS, and then winds up in a three-dimensional representation of like fifth-dimensional space. Is that putting it right, guys?
Yeah, there's a funny line that the robot has that sums it up very quickly. That's something like that.
Yeah. Did that scene worked for all of you?
That scene of him looking into the bedroom.
Looking into the bedroom and yeah. Like being in that weird.
I like that just because he committed to it.
Yeah. it went there.
Because there was a time when they first go through the black hole. There are several moments in the movie that bring 2001 to mind. And that was one where they're like tunneling through the thing. And I wanted him to like just have like a 3-minute sequence of just that. And he didn't like push that as far as I wanted. But by the climax, like that climax in terms of the information that's in it could have been like 2 or 3 minutes, but he just stretches it out so much. And I kind of just, at a certain point, I was just satisfied that he dived so deeply into it. And it's just, I don't know, pretty moving.
Yeah. There's something to be said for boldness and audacity, but it sounded as though Nick might.
Yeah. Nick was mixed.
I don't know. It's just, it's a little dopey, I think, on several conceptual levels. From just the concept of it seems kind of, it seems weirdly easy, I guess, as far as shaping narrative goes. And on top of that, it's also, you know, it's kind of, I saw this tweet recently That's where someone said that Interstellar is like 2001 A Space Odyssey with an audio commentary track you can't turn off. And that's kind of what that scene felt like to me, where you have TARS explaining, well, this room is... And it's just... I feel like you don't need that. I feel like it just... The scene kind of... Regardless of how well it's executed, and I do have bones to pick with the execution, regardless of that, I still feel like you just don't need to have it said out loud. It kind of kills the wonder of it. And I... So I don't know. It feels like a slight stumble.
For me, it's a slight stumble. I feel like there's very few graceful ways to do that scene. I do, however, like the fact that that scene informs us that the beings that we think are like benevolent aliens, which, you know, fine, I'll take it, are actually like us. Like our future evolved selves. Giving our past selves a chance because we've kind of reached that level.
Mm-hmm.
There's something nice about that idea. Again, it's that hopefulness. It's like we're not being rescued from without. We're being rescued from within. What?
Wow.
You know what? Fuck you. One of the other heartbreaking moments in this movie is when you realize that... So Anne Hathaway has found a new home for us. She's wandering around without her space helmet on. It's a little bit desert-esque, but, you know, that's just one portion. And the fact that she can hang out unprotected seems pretty great. The thing that kind of hurts the most about that is when you realize, as she's, like, burying the person that she loved, is that they died of old age waiting for her. Like... She is just as old as Cooper is, which is like 123, I think they said at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've done all of these things that seem to have taken place in hours, but they've actually been influencing the future of humanity over the course of almost a century.
Certainly.
And, you know, it's one of those things where you kind of have to keep going back and like rethinking about things. Because like, Cooper is found... on the other side of the wormhole by Saturn. And they're like, well, you know, it's a good thing we got to you. You only had 2 hours of air left. And then you realize that it's been like 80 years since he got his message through to his daughter. And so just kind of collapsing and expanding these time frames in your head can become a little overwhelming. But I kind of love that about this movie. I love that it makes you think about things like that. Again, you know, scientific, interesting, relativity-related things, in addition to this is a man who so loved his daughter and so wanted to be back with her that he took these extreme chances, and he trusted in that force to be able to pull through the rest of humanity as well. It was quite fantastic. Any final thoughts on Interstellar before we go?
I feel like I had responded to someone who I follow on Twitter yesterday when they were asking, they don't understand the sort of the almost violent hatred some people have for Christopher Nolan, and I said that I think that the words Christopher Nolan are kind of like modern film culture's why don't you play a little solitaire? I'm not even going to explain the reference.
Yeah,
if you don't know it, look it up. But that kind of came to mind. I don't know. It's interesting. It's interesting just how... I think it's the whole... He should have never made a superhero film. That's his biggest mistake, honestly. Regardless of how well they did, regardless of how much he did for his career, it has attracted the most awful people as his fans. And it's basically... It's allowed sort of these very kind of... small-minded types to launch attacks, basically, because they sort of act like his films are what justify their existence as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And it also kind of has dulled the discourse around his movies, because I think that his strengths and limitations are all very interesting to think about, especially someone who is being given this sort of platform. How in really not a long span of time he went from making small thrillers to, you know, the 70mm IMAX spectacle. Yeah. That was, you know, that evokes Spielberg and Kubrick, and I think, can do both of them proud, at least at various moments.
Yeah, a friend of mine, you know, said that this film worked for him, and then he expanded on it saying, like, he connected more emotionally with this than 2001, which, I mean, I don't think is difficult. 2001 is a very icy movie.
Yeah. But,
you know, if you want to talk, you know, talking about Christopher Nolan, I wanted to look this up because I couldn't remember precisely when Memento came out. It was in 2000. So, like, 14 years...
2001.
So, 14 years, this man, between Memento, which was a great little movie, and this massive, giant
thing. Oh, maybe it was 2000. Okay. Premiered at Venice in September of 2000. That's interesting. Because that's often cited as a big... I think that's often cited as, like, a big Sundance film.
Yeah, I didn't realize it had been there. And this man has been goddamn working. He hasn't really gone like more than 2 or 3 years without a film.
Mm-hmm.
Like he did Following, then 2 years later Memento, 2 years later Insomnia. Obviously took a little break after that because that wasn't as big as it should have been. 3 years later Batman Begins. The next year The Prestige. 2 years later The Dark Knight. 2 years later Inception. 2 years later The Dark Knight Rises. 2 years later Interstellar. I mean,
wow. The
man is working, and these are huge goddamn movies. Like, the man is working at a clip, and I've read stories about him and how, like, efficient he is, and that's one of the reasons that in between superhero films, he was allowed to go out and make another film. Because usually you'd be, like, locked in a contract, and they'd be like, nope, you're not going to be able to do that. But Christopher Nolan was like, hey, look, I saved you so much money, and then I made you so much money, just trust me. And they're just like, all right, yeah, sure.
Dude's a machine.
It's fucking great. But yeah, so Interstellar, out in theaters now. Definitely see it on the biggest screen possible. I had to see it on a LIMAX screen, a digital IMAX. I'm hoping that I'll be able to go actually see it at a 70mm IMAX before it leaves. But yeah, that's it. Unless anyone has any final thoughts they'd like to...
Cooper,
the universe.
Good mission.
Cooper, good mission. Danny King, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so let's get into it. Coming into DVD and Blu-ray, How to Train Your Dragon 2. Was that not out already? Apparently not.
Yes, not.
Wow. Okay, anyway. we also have Let's Be Cops, which I saw and which was minor but slightly funny.
Minor picture.
Yeah. Jersey Boys,
one of the masterworks of the year.
Nick Newman, you kind of seemed like you were excited for Jersey Boys, or did
no?
You
I was. It? I was not. Don't slander me like that.
I'm looking forward to seeing Jersey Boys.
Maybe I did. I don't know. I was a little curious about
it. You said
it
was weird because you don't even like Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons. We got in a fight about this.
I said I was curious about it just because I tend to like Clint Eastwood as a director. I never saw it, though.
So are you excited for American Sniper?
The trailer's really good.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, the trailer's good.
That's coming out this year, right?
Christmas.
Yeah.
You know what's
weird?
They're
really sneaking that one in.
Yeah. What's weird is now, so within 2 months, we'll have two different movies that should have been or were going to be made by Steven Spielberg.
Oh, yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah. That is weird. What the fuck is that guy doing?
He's, I think he finished shooting a Cold War thriller with Tom Hanks.
Oh, that sounds good.
He wasn't doing Robopocalypse, which was another one that he was going to do.
No, it got, I guess the...
Put in turnaround.
The budgeting on it got a little fucked up. But he's got that, and he's going to shoot some Roald Dahl adaptation, the BFG or something.
Oh, yeah.
The Big Fucking Giant or whatever. So,
or Big Friendly Giant, maybe?
Maybe that.
I know BFG in Doom was Big Fucking Gun. Anyway, doesn't matter. Also coming out, Tammy. Did anyone see Tammy? No?
No.
No? Good. other than that, I mean, it's a lot of random stuff. Bunny Lake is Missing is coming out to Blu-ray.
Ooh. UHF.
UHF. Dolls.
I used to love that movie.
You used to love that movie?
I mean, I haven't seen it since I was about 11 years old.
So
but
it's
man.
Very possible that you could still love that movie.
Mm. Oh, I did kind of want to see the James Cameron movie.
Deep Sea Challenge. Thing.
Yeah. But I didn't.
And, yeah, I don't know, it's just I don't know, that's about it.
For some reason, it says The Babadook is coming out on Blu-ray, but I don't think that's true because it's just coming out in theaters now. One other thing, I guess Labor Day is getting a reprinting.
Yeah, because it sold out its initial run.
Yeah.
Because it's amazing.
Oh, sick.
When are we going to do Labor Day?
Maybe Christmas break.
Okay, I'm down for that.
Oh, that's a great idea.
I mean, it's a drunk thing, right?
Yeah, it's going to be wasted.
Maybe, I don't know, I live with three other people. Maybe we could all like crowd around my computer and all get drunk and watch it. And it'll be like a six-person team-up on that movie. Running train on Labor Day.
Wow. Okay. Anyway, coming to theaters next week. Limited release, we have Foxcatcher, the newest film by director Bennett Miller.
Right, I saw that movie.
Did you?
Yeah.
What'd you think?
Mixed.
Okay. Beyond the Lights, which I've never heard of.
Oh, I also saw The Homesman, which is Tommy Lee Jones directed Western.
How is that?
It's good. It has a... Speaking of narrative twists, this one has one. It's a two-hour movie, maybe about like 90 minutes through, that
really... Sleeps up and floors you?
Yeah, that's the term. it's really bizarre, and it's a weird movie, but I think it's worth seeing. And as is his previous Western, Three Burials of
Melchior Estrada.
Yeah, they're both just like weird and pretty distinctive films.
Interesting. We also have Dumb and Dumber 2. The Homesman is coming out unlimited. Rosewater, the directorial debut by Jon Stewart. The Toy Soldiers. And Kirk Cameron's newest film, Saving Christmas. Okay. Any of these striking your fancy? I'm a little interested in The Homesman now.
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear what you think.
I kind of want to see Foxcatcher. We have no idea what we're talking about next week, so don't get excited about that.
Something good.
Coaches, father, coach hair, maha.
Is that...
I can't tell if Danny is doing Steve Carell in Fox Hunter or Ariana Grande. It's really difficult to say.
I was doing Rosewater.
Oh, okay. So let's talk.
That's a true story, asshole.
They're both true stories.
Yeah.
Okay. So now let's just say something that we've watched on our own, and we can get out of here. So, Danny King, what's something you watched on your own?
I had a pretty fun viewing the other day at in the cinema.
The cinema.
Film called Angst, from 1983. Directed by a guy named Gerald Cargill, who I think never made another movie. And it is like, it's gained a reputation because Gaspar Noé, I think when he debuted I Stand Alone, cited it as an influence, called it, quote, one of the masterpieces of the decade, unquote. And it was also notorious because it was just like banned in a lot of places for graphic content. And it's about a killer. So going into it, I was kind of terrified. And the guy who introed the movie called it like an evil film. And he's like, you know, don't lynch us. And, you know, we warned you and everything. So I was expecting like this... I was expecting to be like freaked out and maybe want to leave, but it turned out to be much more thoughtful than I thought. And because the killer, it's not the kind of movie like American Psycho where you're sort of following a mastermind or someone who feels like they're a mastermind and they take pleasure in their kind of behavior. It's a really, I mean, the killer has a running voiceover, which in and of itself is interesting. I wasn't expecting that. And it runs throughout the movie. And he says all these things like, you know, I have the perfect crime planned and I'm going to execute it. But all of his actions are clumsy. And the movie is sort of, it's 80 minutes long. And a lot of it is just real time of him in this house trying to do what he wants to do with this family. And a lot of it is just really taxing physical activity that somehow this actor managed to do. And it's fascinating to watch. And I think I haven't seen that much of Noé's work actually, but the movie has a sort of like possessed camera movement where it's flying around a lot of the times and very intense subjective camera movement. And I think that's sort of something that has been in his work and some of his influence. And actually, the friend I saw the movie with really loves I Stand Alone. But then after he saw this, he was like, now I don't know what to think of I Stand Alone, because it seems like he just took so much of it from Angst. So I'd be curious to see that film. But yeah, thumbs up for Angst.
All right. Nick Newman.
I'm going to quickly, because I want to get out of here.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I'm starving.
I'll quickly recommend a film called Body Snatchers, which is directed by Abel Ferrara. It is from 1994. Have you seen it?
Motherfucking yeah, man.
I'm still kind of a Ferrara neophyte. In fact, the last movie I watched was King of New York, which I recommended on this podcast more than a year ago.
Also good shit.
Yes, both are good shit.
That's the one with baby Christian Bale, right? And he's all like, look at me. The king of New York.
Yeah. No. I found it's funny.
It was a Newsies joke. Anyway, please continue, Nick.
It's funny because Body Snatchers is 87 minutes long. Yep. And I was watching it and I got 27 minutes in and I was kind of not enjoying it that much. I thought it seemed very kind of chintzy and I don't think there was really much interesting going on. It felt kind of like a standard early to mid-90s horror film with some nice visual touches accepted. And then I paused it because someone came over. And then after they left, I unpaused it. And the movie's 87 minutes long. The 27-minute mark, the entire next hour was really quite good. And I paused it at the first really good scene. So it was this strange viewing experience I had where I wonder if maybe my appreciation of it is sort of dominated by the fact that the best parts of it are very much at the forefront of my experience. it's a very intelligent film. I think that it understands how you can provide these sort of formal setups and reversals as a good way of communicating this idea of body snatching, the way that you can employ very subtle shots, very subtle movements of the camera to establish a very frightening undercurrent where it's much more difficult to tell in this movie than, say, the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, who is who and when they've been switched over. And I was compelled by this this notice from Ignaty Vyshnovetsky, who, when he wrote about Abel Ferrara, he said something like, it's the most terrifying ending because the scary thing is that humanity persists and its evil continues. And I really love that idea.
Yeah.
And Body Snatchers, it's not a difficult film to find. I was able to rent the DVD from Netflix, and I think you can rent it from Amazon on Amazon Prime for like $3 or something. It's definitely worth your time. I was a week late in my horror film viewing, but I suppose it sort of made up for it. Good film. I'll watch Miss 45 probably today to continue the Ferrara kick.
Nice. Mine's going to be super quick. I watched Sleeping Beauty, the animated film by the Disney Corporation. I love that movie. The animation style is gorgeous. The songs are good. How can they not be? They basically stole the entire score from the Tchaikovsky ballet. But there's something about it. There's something about the way that they are able to... And I mean, a lot of those early movies were full force all the time music anyway. So the fact that it's balletic and feeds off of those cues and everything really works. Not to mention that, again, the animation is gorgeous. Maleficent, I haven't seen the movie Maleficent, but Maleficent has been one of my favorite villains for the longest time because she's just so freaking evil. And I love the fact that it's just like, oh, her, she's just evil and that she doesn't have like a reason for it. That's just kind of like her nature. And spoiler alert, when she chains up Prince Philip and then like shows him her vision of the future wherein she'll release him after like 80 years so he can like slink off on his nearly dead horse and still have his romantic victory is just so bleak and amazing. I love that movie. It's great. I'm glad I own it now. That's it. That's all for today. Join us next week. We'll be talking about something. We're not quite sure yet. So stick around. It'll be a pleasant surprise.
You know, Sleeping Beauty is one of my very first cinematic memories, actually.
Really?
I don't think I've ever seen the full movie, but when I was a kid, I had a VHS of it. One of my first memories of watching a film is I'm lying on my bed. I'm maybe 3 or 4 years old, and it's a shot of a horse-drawn carriage going up the spiral side of a mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know which shot I'm talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, it's weird, because I have not seen it since then. Certainly have not seen it since then, but I just remember that shot specifically. And it's sort of like been lodged in my brain, so yeah, the movie holds a special place, even if I've never actually seen it.
I hadn't seen it in full, like, in the longest time, and I was just surprised at how much of it I remembered from childhood. Like, the whole opening scene, it's just, like, nuts how much it stuck with me. But that's that. Let's tell the fine people where we can be found at home. Where we can be found at home. Currently in my bedroom. We'll be in the kitchen later. Let's tell the fine people where we can be found in the meantime. Danny King, where can we find you on the internet?
Thefilmstage.com, Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin, and C. Nolan.
C. Nolan. Okay. Anyway, Nick Newman, where can we find you?
Thefilmstage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and Transcending Time and Space.
And you can find me on Twitter.com/BrianJerowen, Thefilmstage.com, obviously, and my personal site, DearFilm.net. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and tune in next week.